Okay. The Mishnah says, the Mishnah in Masechet Tanis says that Misha Nichnas Av Mima'atim B'Simcha, that when the month of Av begins, then happiness is decreased. Now, the fact that happiness is decreased doesn't mean there's no happiness. It just means that happiness is decreased. The Gemara then says, and I would assume that anybody who's been certainly around the yeshiva for the last couple of days.
What is the month of Av?
The month of Av is in the summer. That's when the temple is destroyed. Okay? Anybody who's been around Jerusalem, or certainly yeshivas the last couple of days, have probably heard this mantra repeated over and over again, Misha Nichnas Adar Marbim B'Simcha, which means that when the month of Adar begins, then happiness is increased, joy is increased. So that's the statement for this actually comes in the Talmud. It says as follows, Amar Rav Yehuda, Bereid Rav Shmuel Bar Shilat, Mishmei Derav, Kishem Kishamisha Nichnas Av Mima'atim B'Simcha, Kach Misha Nichnas Adar Mar B'Misimcha. Just as when the month of Av comes in, we decrease in joy, when the month of Adar comes in, we increase in joy. Now, this comparison, just as, kishem, just as, is a very strange comparison. And at face value, we do not understand it. The month of Av has within it what's called the ninth of Av, Tisha B'Av. The ninth of Av is the day of the temple. The day of both temples were destroyed. Leading up to the ninth of Av are a three-week period of mourning from the day that the walls of Jerusalem were breached to the day that the actual destruction took place. So as you get closer and closer to the destruction, one would understand how this is a time which is a sad time. And one would understand how this time increases in sadness as you get closer and closer to the date of destruction. Now, that makes sense when you speak about the month of Av. But when you speak about the month of Adar, which began yesterday, when you speak of the month of Adar, why Mishenichnas Adar Marbim B'Simcha? Why when the month of Av begins would joy be increased? Ostensibly, there's only one thing about the month which should be an impetus for joy. And that's a holiday that takes place on the 14th of the month. That's called Purim. So why would you say that just because of Purim, this whole month should be a month of joy? I'm saying that it doesn't seem to make sense. And again, why from when the month begins? To compound our difficulties, Rashi, in his commentary, instead of helping us, confuses us. Because Rashi explains why, when Adar begins, is there going to be a time of increased happiness, increased joy. Misha Nichnas Adar, Rashi writes, Yimei Nisim Hayu LiYisrael, because this is a time of miracles for the Jewish people, and then he spells out what these miracles are, Purim UPesach. The miracles took place through the holidays of Purim and the holiday of Pesach, of Passover, which is all good except for one small point. The holiday of Passover is, of course, not in the month of Adar. The holiday of Passover is in the next month, the month of Nisan. So, first of all, Rashi seems to be telling us that when it says, Misha Nichnas Adar, Marbim B'Simcha, that there is this idea, there's this ethic, there's this advice, at least, perhaps command, that when Adar begins, joy should increase. I guess most of you, especially severe yeshiva students, wanted to know exactly when you have to stop the joy, because one does not want to have too much joy in their lives. Who knows what that can possibly lead to? So here we're told that the joy that begins with the beginning of Adar should continue all the way through Passover. But I guess for most people, if we would play a word association game, I say joy and you say Passover. I mean, Passover is not necessarily the first thing that comes to one's mind when one thinks of joy. So as I said, we have multiple problems over here. wife in the beginning of the month, what the month is about, why Passover is included within the discussion. So in order to get some insight in this, what I want to try to do is to look a little bit deeper into what this the month of Adar is, and for that matter, what is the connection between Purim and Passover. So let's start with simple things, and then we'll see that nothing is simple and everything is more complex than it seems.
Wouldn't the happy time be with Simchas Torah, the giving of the Torah?
Yes.
And wouldn't that go throughout the whole year and just the sad time be with the destruction of the temple?
So you're saying the default is that we should be happy.
Yeah, and I also don't understand Purim. Maybe I don't know the story well enough, but Purim would...
Okay, so that's your homework. You have to go back and read the story.
I know the story, but where's the miracle in Purim other than Ahasuerus falling in love with Esther?
Well, a Jewish girl wins a beauty contest. That's not a miracle. You shouldn't laugh that loud. You'll get in trouble for that. The miracle on Purim is very different from the miracle on Passover. They're almost inverse to one another. Because the miracle on Passover, you're talking 10 plagues, you're talking splitting of the sea, pyrotechnics, very, very impressive stuff. When you look at the story of Purim and the miracle of Purim, the whole miracle seems to take place in coincidental fashion. You can't point your finger and say, oh, look at that miracle, which perhaps goes back to the very definition of what a miracle is. I mean, a miracle is not... Okay, let's be very clear about this. The most important... A miracle is like a joke. What's the most important thing about the joke? It's timing. It's timing. Is that you should say the joke right before people laugh, right? Otherwise, it doesn't work very well. What's the most important thing about a miracle is timing. I mean, an earthquake can take place any time. If your enemies surround you and an earthquake takes place and they get swallowed up, that's very impressive. If, matter of fact, you say, let the earth swallow you up, and it swallows you up, so now you would say miracle. Right? Now, what if just they were coming to attack you and they get swallowed up? You wouldn't say, well, that's pretty cool? How cool does something have to be a miracle? Maybe that's the question. Which means sometimes miracles take place, and the person who the miracle takes place to may not realize it at all. You know, remember like those cartoons where the safe comes falling out of the, right, and it just misses the person? So again, what exactly is a miracle? But we would like to believe that God is involved in creation on two different levels, that sometimes God does things which goes really against the rules of nature, but sometimes God manipulates nature in such a way that only those who are paying attention are able to smile and to appreciate and say, wow, look what God just now did. And the whole story of Purim, where God's name does not appear even one time, is such a story. It's where if you pay attention, you read the book carefully, you realize that that was not just coincidence. And I want to maybe explain this a little bit deeper even. The protagonist in the story of Purim is someone called Haman Agagi. Haman from Agag. So if you just read the book of Esther, it doesn't give you lineage, it doesn't give you background, it doesn't tell you who this person is. If you would know your Bible well, you will know that Agag is the royal family of a people called Amalek. Amalek do not like Jews. Amalek is the prototype, the archetype of the anti-Semite. When the Jews leave Egypt, now, is this after the Passover story, or is this part of the Passover story? When the Jews leave Egypt, and the sea has been split, and the plagues have taken place, and the Jews are marching on their way to Mount Sinai, and maybe that's something that we need to stress. What is the fulfillment of leaving Egypt? Meaning, where does leaving Egypt lead to? What is the objective? So that's a very difficult question to answer, because how broad do you want to analyze this? How much do you want to stretch the canvas? How much do you want to take in when you want to try to analyze such a question? Because I can say that the objective of Egypt is the Messiah's coming. I mean, or I can say it's just getting to Mount Sinai. Or I can say it's entering into the land of Israel. So let me discount something. I don't believe that the end of the story of leaving Egypt is entering into the land of Israel. I believe that's another holiday. That's something else. And as much as people make note that Moses' name is not in the Passover Haggadah, entering Israel is also not in the Passover Haggadah. That's not part of the same story. That's a different story. But what is the culmination of the Passover story? So I believe that that would be receiving the Torah at Sinai. And in fact, if you think about it, that's what Jews do. We count the days from leaving Egypt to standing at Sinai. When you count between two different things, what you effectively have done is that you've linked two things together, which means the Torah is telling us link between the receiving of the Torah and link between leaving Egypt. These things are connected. A matter of fact, I've mentioned this a couple of times, but most of you aren't here, so I guess it doesn't make that much of a difference. When Moses is standing by the burning bush and he says to God, will I really take the Jews out of Egypt? And God says, I'll give you a sign. So there's two ways to know what the sign is. One is to know what it says, and the other is to let your mind play tricks on you. When your mind plays tricks on you, you say, oh, what's the sign? He takes the staff and turns it into a serpent. Or he takes his hand and he puts it in and it turns white. That's not what it says. Those come afterwards. What was the sign? The sign is that when I take the people out, you will serve God on this mountain. Which means Moses is questioning, how will I really take that? God says, no, the whole objective over here is to come back to this mountain. And those of you who've never paid attention to it, the mountain with the burning bush, which is called the Sneh in Hebrew, later on becomes the same place where Mount Sinai is. Sinai is called Sinai because of the Sneh. The Sneh means the burning bush, which means the revelation of the burning bush is a microcosm of the larger revelation, which takes place at Sinai. So before Moses ever starts his mission, the objective is already told. You need to take the people out, and then you need to hook back and come right back to this place, and then something significant will happen. So, to attempt to answer your question about, shouldn't Jews always be happy? Of course the answer is yes, Jews should always be happy. But I will point out, therefore, that there is linkage between the Jews leaving Egypt and receiving the Torah. And maybe right there we need to take note of something. The Jews receiving the Torah didn't work out that well. It was supposed to work out much better, but it didn't work out well at all. Because as you know, Moses goes up, Moses is hanging out with God, Moses comes down, and the people are in the middle of a party. Now, it says in the prophets that there's a fast of the fourth month, the fifth month, the seventh month, and the tenth month. And the prophet Zechariah says that one day these fast days will become days of celebration. To which leads you to a very simple question. What celebration was supposed to take place? See, people have a soul. People's souls is their individuality, it's their charisma, but it's their spiritual potential. And I think all of us recognize there are some people with incredible spiritual potential. Sometimes it's used, sometimes it's not used. Judaism understands that days, that time, also has potential to it. And there are days that have potential. And as you all know with people as well, when potential is realized, it's glorious. When potential is not realized, then it's devastating. Now I'll go back and we'll begin to understand what you touched on. When Moses comes down from the mountain holding the tablets, what were the people doing? It says they were worshiping a golden calf. What else were they doing? It says they were eating and drinking and they were partying. Achlu v'shasu v'komu l'tzachek. Rashi tells us, what does it mean, komu l'tzachek? And Rashi paints a very, very negative and frightening picture. Rashi says that an orgy broke out, which means foot of Mount Sinai, supposed to be the holiest thing imaginable. Instead of receiving the Torah, what you end up having is the complete opposite. I mean, I've played with this idea a little bit, just to visualize it, because all of us are somewhat challenged in terms of our imagination. We can only visualize things if we think of television. But if you imagine what receiving the Torah is about, when Moses comes down, imagine a split screen. Imagine Moses on the highest point of the mountain, more than the highest point of the mountain. His feet are a little bit above the highest point of the mountain, and Moses is off in heaven. And you can imagine the most ethereal situation. You can't see God, but what you have is just this incredible scene of feelings of love, of soft colors. You with me still? And you have the softest, most delightful music playing in the background. You with me? Harp or violin? Which one?
Harp.
And at the same time, you see the split screen coming on the other side, a wild party breaking out with singing and dancing and every other thing that you can possibly imagine and some things that you couldn't imagine. And you probably have the same exact tune but turned into heavy metal being played down below. You like this or this works? Which means on the one hand, we're supposed to be up there in heaven getting the Torah, but look what we're doing instead. And I didn't mean, if anybody is involved in heavy metal, I personally apologize for the implication that it's something less than incredibly spiritual. But I just did that by way of illustration in terms of like really understanding what's going on, potential versus reality. Now, think it through. When Moses comes down, what does he see? He sees this rave going on, right? He sees this unbelievable party going on, and they're all dancing around this golden calf. Now, what was supposed to happen when Moses comes down? What were they supposed to be doing? Were they supposed to be having a party? Were they supposed to be singing and dancing? Yes, they were supposed to be singing and dancing and eating and drinking and having a party, but what party should that have been? Go ahead.
The celebrating of
Simchas Torah. That was supposed to be Simchas Torah, but we blew it. That's it. No Simchas Torah. Instead, what do you have? What's the day that he comes down? Shivasa B'Tammuz, and it becomes a fast day. It's supposed to be a day of celebration. It got turned into a fast day. Now, when does Moses go up the second time, or perhaps the third time? When does he go up to get the second set of tablets? He goes up on the first day of Elul. He's there for 40 days, and he comes down the second time. It's Yom Kippur. And this is real interesting. What do Jews do on Yom Kippur? We don't eat, we don't drink, we don't party. Why not? Because Yom Kippur comes to fix that which we broke when we were supposed to receive the Torah. That's where Yom Kippur gets its laws from. The laws of Yom Kippur are an expression of the terrible mistake that we made at the foot of the mountain. And if you really want to think this through deeply, perhaps you'd appreciate that this idea of eating in the inopportune time, or perhaps drinking at the inopportune time, really goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden itself, where God sets up the situation and says, you can eat from all the trees, don't eat from this one. And you know the way that the human mind then works. Which one do you want? You want the one that you can't have. In fact, when the evil inclination is represented by the serpent, and the serpent says to Eve, you cannot eat from all the trees of the field. Now, did he lie? Did he tell the truth? He told the truth. You can't eat from them all. What can you eat from? All of them except for one. But that's the way the human mind works. You can't have all of them, so what do you say? I can't eat from all of them. Instead of saying, wow, I can eat from all of these, except for one. You know the old argument? Do you say that the glass is half full, the glass is half empty? The Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, what does it say? It says the glass is half empty. What are we supposed to say? No. What are we supposed to say? So now you don't say anymore. What are we supposed to say? We're supposed to say, they have all the water that I need, and God gave me a big glass to hold it in. Right? Because if your glass is filled to the very top, what are you going to do? You're going to spill it. So you're not supposed to say, oh, look, the glass is half empty. What do you say? If this is as much water as God gave me, I have all the water I need. But thank God I also have a big glass to hold it in. Right? It's not that the glass is half full. That's not the way you're supposed to look at it. You remember this, you'll save a lot of money in therapy. Okay? Right. But what the serpent says, oh, look at that, the glass is half empty. It focuses on what you don't have. And what you don't have, you get upset and you get sad. And what does it then say afterwards? What's the punishment that man then gets? You're going to have to start working for your daily bread and you'll be eating in sadness. That's one of the things it says. And we're back to sadness again. Now, for those of you who I've so far completely confused, I will attempt to confuse you a little bit more, and then we'll try to liberate you from your confusion, if still possible. I really am sad for the Jews who only come to synagogue on Yom Kippur. Think about what a skewed view of Judaism they have. They see a bunch of people, don't eat, praying obsessively. There's a sadness, there's a seriousness. Now, I'm not saying Judaism shouldn't be serious. I'm not saying that Judaism... But think about, like, most basic Jewish thought. Why does God create us? Why does God put us on this earth? And the Talmud tells us that when we're judged, when we stand in the day of judgment, God will ask us of every single legitimate pleasure that we could have had what we chose not to have and say, why didn't you choose that? Why didn't you have that pleasure? Tells us, the Jews in Talmud tells us how certain rabbis, whenever a new fruit came to town, it was a traveling markets in those days, and a new fruit came in, they would make sure to buy it so that they wouldn't have... So they would have what to answer in the day of judgment. Right. I'm not saying you have to eat your string beans more than once. You have to try it once and say, I tried it. That's it. My wife was very friendly with a rabbi named Rabbi Breuer. She used to drive him to and from classes. And he's a great-grandson of Rav Shmuel Ferl Hirsch. If you know who that is. Hirsch was the greatest rabbi in Germany, 19th century. And when he got old, he once asked his children to take him to see the Alps. And he says, and they said to him, what are you going to do by the Alps? You're a little old to ski. What are you going to do by the Alps? So he said, I'm getting old, and I'm worried that I'm going to die. When I get to heaven, God's going to say to me, so, what do you think of my Alps? What am I going to answer? You know I'm saying, is that an unbelievable approach? That's what Judaism is. God put us on this earth and said, enjoy it. And with no, you know, desire of insulting anybody in any of the religions, Christianity has screwed this up for all of us because it makes us feel that this world is something that one should feel guilty about when one has any kind of pleasure involved in it. Judaism does not entertain the same type of puritanical approach. Judaism says the purpose why we're here is to enjoy ourselves. And now I look at Yom Kippur and I say, Yom Kippur is not a representative day of what Judaism, of what normative Judaism is. Yom Kippur is a day which is not normative, but it's necessary. Why is Yom Kippur necessary? Because we messed up with the golden calf. So when you mess up, you need to do what's called a tikkun. Tikkun means fixing. Fixing can take place in terms of one's life, in terms of one's body, in terms of one's soul, in terms of the whole world. When you take a day with the Jews who were supposed to have Simchas Torah, supposed to have an incredible amount of joy, but that joy dissipates, that joy disappears, that joy was twisted. And instead of being a joy towards God, it becomes a time which results in having to create a balance, and there was joy illegitimately taken, now we need to have the fasting of Yom Kippur. And as I've already said, what happens by the foot of Mount Sinai is an echo of what already happened in the Garden of Eden. We're good so far?
I have two questions. Number one, you're saying that Simchas, that you received the Torah on Yom Kippur.
Correct. And that's why Simchas Torah, before you ask the second question, that's why Simchas Torah is in the fall. Then that's why we celebrate receiving the Torah in the fall. Because you say, hold it, Shavuos is when God gave the Torah. But we didn't accept it then. And when we talk about Shavuos, we say Yom Matan Torah Tenu, the day that God gave the Torah. We don't say the day that we received the Torah because we didn't. We blew it. Now, what about Yom Kippur brings about the forgiveness? The forgiveness of Yom Kippur is an outgrowth of the Jews finally accepting the Torah. When a Jew accepts upon themselves the Torah, that's what cleanses. That's what brings forgiveness. And make no mistake about it. You don't have to wait for Yom Kippur. You can beat the holiday rush and you can accept the Torah at any point. A Jew accepts the Torah They're purged. They're forgiven. They're cleansed. Yes.
Why would I always thought that Yom Kippur was a relationship with Rosh Hashanah?
I don't know. I don't know where you were taught. I don't know who taught you. But if you want, we can have a class action suit. We can make a lot of money.
So does that have to do with Rosh Hashanah?
I'll put it a little differently. If we were closer to Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, I'd give a whole talk about that. But it's interesting, what exactly is the relationship between Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur? Because Rosh Hashanah really represents creation of the world. Creation of the world, when was the first Rosh Hashanah? Thousands, thousands of years ago. When was the first Yom Kippur? Matter of fact, I'll tell you a little secret. Yom Kippur is never mentioned in the Torah till after the golden calf. And not only that, there is a mention of the various holidays when Moses goes up the mountain in chapter 23, which is last week's portion before. Are you with me? Before Moshe comes down and before the golden calf, there's a list of the holidays. Yom Kippur's not there in that list. If you ask me, Yom Kippur was in that list because it wasn't needed yet. Yom Kippur only takes its personality afterwards. But as I said, according to Jewish tradition, Yom Kippur is there because that's the day that the Jews were forgiven. And that becomes very clear. I'll tell you another thing about this. What did the Kohen Gadol do on Yom Kippur? So it says that he would take incense, he would make a big cloud of smoke, and then he would enter into the Holy of Holies. Why? And the term used for cloud of smoke there is Anan. Where was the previous time in the Torah that the term Anan is used? On Mount Sinai, which means that the whole service of Yom Kippur is to recreate the giving of the Torah. Okay, there's a lot more to talk about, but till you understand that point, the whole thing is a mystery to you. Once you understand that, then things begin to make sense.
I was also taught here that Rosh Hashanah, it was not the creation of the world, but it was starting from when God breathed soul into Adam.
Yeah. Did I say that last week? Were you here when I said that? Or you heard someone else say it? There's actually an argument when creation takes place. If creation is, we talked about this last week, no? If creation takes place in Tishrei or Nisan. So the way that it's resolved among the commentaries is that the thought of creation is in Tishrei, but the actual creation is in Nisan. Okay. Let's see how much of this I can work in, and then I'll have to get back to where, more or less to where I began. Where do we start? That when Adar begins, joy begins. What I've been suggesting to you till now is that the joy is the way that things are supposed to be, and as you said before, that should be the default. Joy should be the default, but something went terribly wrong. And when something goes terribly wrong, we need to fix it. Fixing it is not simple. In fact, the whole Elul leading into Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, which are 40 days. Again, where's the beginning of Yom Kippur? Begins the first day of Elul. Where are those 40 days from? Those are the 40 days that Moses is on the mountain. Moses is praying to God not to destroy the people, and Moses received the Torah for the second time. Those are those 40 days of forgiveness that begin with the first day of Elul, and that's why we're blowing the shofar during that entire period. Which means these are days of prayer. But what I want to stress is that these are days which are serious. These are days which are severe. These are days which we're trying to reject the mistakes that we've made, and trying to, in a sense, to recreate ourselves. Okay, and that culminates with Yom Kippur. Why is Simchas Torah then? Once we accept the Torah, we need to celebrate Simchas Torah. Okay, but let's stop. How does Adar fit into this, and how does Pesach fit into this? So the first thing that I want to stress is that what did Rashi say? That Adar and Nisan are linked. Pesach and Purim are linked. How are they linked? So I never got there yet. I'll show you two ways that they're linked. First, Talmud teaches you 30 days before Passover, you're supposed to start learning the laws of Passover. What are 30 days before Passover? Purim, which means what should you be doing during your Purim Suda, during your Purim celebration? You just have to start talking about Passover. So that you can say is just a coincidence. Let's flip it around a second. Do you remember the story of Esther? When Esther tells Mordechai, go and collect all the Jews and have them fast for me for 3 days. What were those 3 days? What month was that in? Those 3 days were in Nisan, and those 3 days were the day before Passover, the first day and the second day of Passover. The Jews fasted on Passover that year. When Esther finally has her party, and invites Achashverosh and Haman in, when is that? That's during Passover. When the next night, when they invite a second time, when is that? That's the next day of Passover, during what's called Chol HaMoed. When Haman is killed, when is that? On Passover. Which means if I were to ask you, is there any connection, any correlation between Passover and Purim? What's the answer? Absolutely. Because the whole story, the narrative, the climax of the story unfolds on Passover. So of course there's going to be linkage between Passover and Purim. Now, that's one side of it. But as I've already told you, Passover is not the end of the story. But maybe let's go back to Purim for a moment. When the Talmud asks, what terrible thing did the Jews do that they deserved to be threatened to be killed on Purim? The Talmud answers, what is it? They ate by the party of Achashverosh. Which means we're right back to the same type of sin all over again. Eating in an inappropriate manner. You know, let's also be honest. I would assume that they didn't have a mashkiach, that the food wasn't glatt kosher by Achashverosh's party. I would assume that what we're talking about over here is a party where the whole ethic of the party was inappropriate. And by the way, it's much worse than you would think. And this is due to our lack of understanding of history. When does the story of Purim begin? If you were to look at the book of Esther, how long does the book stretch? How many years from the beginning to end of the book?
9 years,
correct. I was going to give them homework to do. You ruined it for them.
Sorry.
It's okay. It's 9 years from the beginning to the end of the book. When does what else is happening in the world during this time? Because you know, sometimes you look at a story and you don't know what's going on someplace else, and consequently you don't really understand the story. When the book begins, the Jews have already started to build the second temple, which then leads to a real good question. Why are these Jews still in Shushan? Why aren't they in Jerusalem? So, of course, you all know the sad answer to that. Most Jews did not come back to build the second temple. Most Jews stayed behind. But now you realize, you know, how ironic it is that instead of being in Israel helping build the temple, these Jews are behind in Shushan, and then the building gets stopped. And according to rabbis, that is what Achashverosh is celebrating at this point, that the Jewish prophecies of one day returning to the land have failed. The Jews will not be returning to the land. And there's even a connotation that when they celebrated, they were using some of the utensils from the temple itself. So if the Jews are by a party using utensils from the temple, off in Shushan and not in Israel, now you begin to appreciate how bad it is that the Jews are by that party, which, by the way, makes it conceptually not all that different, or thematically not all that different from what Adam and Eve did, or for that matter, what the Jews did by the foot of Mount Sinai. It's inappropriate celebration. Now, it's interesting. What does Esther do when Esther wants to somehow try to fix this and stop this? What does Esther say? I want everyone to fast. Again, why would fasting be the solution? Because eating is the problem. Right? So if eating the problem is the problem, then fasting becomes a solution. Right? Because again, Jews are not just into fasting. It's not the way it's supposed to be. There is a fascinating statement which is quoted in a Hasidic book, which is called the Shem Yishmuel. He quotes his father on this teaching. His father was the Sukkotchev Rebbe, the Avni Nezer. And he says as follows, Adar is to Nisan what Elul is to Tishrei. Now let me say that in English. Just like you need a month to prepare before you can get to Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, you just can't like walk into Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, you need to prepare spiritually for it. You need the month of Adar to prepare in order to be able to approach the month of Nisan. Which means when we talk about liberation, what really is liberation? What does it mean to be liberated? You know, and as much as I believe that Passover is one of the greatest things that Jews have given the world It's a yearly lesson in freedom. It's the longest playing educational program in the history of the world. Every year, Jews get together, have an educational, audio-visual learning experience about what it means to be free. And I have no doubt in my mind that Jews who are involved in all kinds of causes for freedom is to a large extent based upon the old Passover lesson. And if you know what it's like to be disenfranchised, you know what it's like to be a slave, that hopefully what you'll develop inside you is a moral imperative to make sure that there isn't going to be slavery and abuse by other people in this world. That's what the Passover message is. But what exactly is freedom? I mean, how do you know that you're free? Free from what? What does it mean to really be liberated? Is Janis Joplin right? It's not her. She didn't write it. She just sang it. Chris Christopherson. Right? Freedom's just another word for having nothing left to lose. What do you do for an encore to that? Overdose. I guess there's nothing left to do. Right? That's not what freedom is. That's probably one of the more cynical statements that I've ever made. What really is freedom? So the world is abused. The world is in pain. How exactly did you get to liberation? Now we go back to what we discussed in the very beginning. When the month of Adar begins, there should be an increase in joy. Very, very simple. An increase of joy. And Rashi then told us that the joy should flow through the month all the way taking us to Passover, at which point there should be even more liberation, and that should be the highlight. But I've already told you that it doesn't end right there. I've also stressed, and again, just to understand this properly, just as the beginning of Elul flows into Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur and then takes you all the way to the last day. What's the last day? It's called Atzeres, Shmini Atzeres. And what does that lead you to? Simchas Torah, where you wanted to get us to right away. There's another day in the holiday called Atzeres. What's the other time called Atzeres? That's what you call Shavuos. Instead of the end of a seven-day holiday, it's at the end of 7 weeks, which means the 7 weeks between Passover and the giving of the Torah is similar. Again, thematically, it's similar to the 7 days from the beginning of the Sukkot holiday to the end of it. Which means here's the eighth day, and there is what happens after 7 weeks. It's not the eighth day, but it's a very similar process. If you're really able to understand this properly, Adar somehow must link all the way to Sivan. Let me give you a little way that you can feel this, just so that you have a clue what I'm talking about. Moses is not the hero on Passover. And the Haggadah works very hard to tell you he's not the hero. I'm repeating myself, forgive me, that when Moses says to God, "Will I take the people out?" What does God say? "No, I'm going to take the people out." How do I know that God really took the people out? Could Moses have done it without God, or can God have done it without Moses? Right? This is a mathematical question. Okay? Now I'll ask you again. Who took the people out of Egypt, Moses or God? God, clearly. But when it comes to Mount Sinai, here Moses has an active role. Mount Sinai, God speaks to Moses, and the other people are watching and listening. God speaks to Moses. Here Moses becomes an active participant. Who's the hero on the holiday of Shavuot? Who's the hero? Moses is the hero. Now, Moses gets revealed in all of his glory on Shavuos, right? Now, it's a very interesting thing. When the Talmud asks, why exactly did Haman choose, and who is Haman? Haman is from Amalek. What does Amalek believe in? Coincidence. Coincidence. There is no God, everything is coincidence. Amalek numerically, is equal to 240. 240 is mar. Mar means bitter. Amalek numerically is safek. Safek means doubts. When the Jews leave Egypt, and the Jews are marching on the way to Mount Sinai, somebody stops them, approaches them, wages war against them. At which point, when the Jews say, "Is God with us or not?" At that point, the next verse is Vayavo Amalek. Amalek comes. Later on in Deuteronomy, when it retells the story of Amalek attack, what does it say? Asher karecha b'derech. When they happened upon you, which is a fascinating turn of phrase, when the Jews have an approach to the world that things are coincidence, then they become susceptible to an attack by Amalek. When Haman was looking for a date to destroy the Jews, he chose the month of Adar. Why? Because he says that's the day, that's in that month Moses dies. And if Moses dies in that month, the Jews must be weak in that month. Because how do the Jews defeat Amalek in the desert? What does it say? Amalek attacks and Moses lifts his hands heavenward. Not that Moses' hands can do magic, but rather because Moses focuses them up on heaven, up to heaven. Moses points to heaven, the Jews all look up at heaven, and that takes away their doubts. Now they see the hand of God in all kinds of things that maybe would have looked like a coincidence. They really don't know God is behind it. Which means Haman looks for a time that Moshe isn't there. And if Moshe isn't here, now the Jews can be defeated. When does Moshe disappear? When Moshe dies. What does Haman not appreciate? That on the 7th of Adar is also the day that Moshe was born. But when Moshe was born, why can't Haman see it? Because Moshe was hidden. Right? That's what it says in the Torah. Remember this? It says that his mother hid him. For how long did she hide him? 3 months. For 3 months. What day does Moshe become revealed if he's born on the 7th of Adar? When are 3 months over? Sivan. Which means that the time when the Torah is given, that's when Moshe gets revealed. Which means what Adar is really about, it links with Passover, but Passover links with Shavuos, and what all of this is about is the light of bringing the Torah into the world, but you can't always see it. Because Purim and Adar is when things are a little bit more hidden. Things aren't obvious. It's not like the splitting of the sea, and it's not like the Nile turning into blood. That takes a little bit longer. But before you get to the real miracles, before you get to these bombastic miracles, we need to be able to see other kinds of miracles. And if a person's going to wait their whole life, just, you know, God, just give me one really big miracle, and then I'll be happy, that person may never be happy. Person will be happy, person will have joy in their lives if they're able to see the little miracles that happen every single day. The little things which sometimes are hidden, sometimes no one really notices. And then you just realize, no, that was God involved in my life. Which means realize that Moses is hidden for these 3 months. And then you have the glory of the giving the Torah where the heavens open up and the sound comes down. But now let's follow it all the way through. And what happens then? What happens then is the Jews mess up. And when they mess up and they eat and they drink inappropriately, they bring sadness back to the world. And what could have been a happy day gets turned into a sad time. And now Moses will have to go up again for another 40 days. And that's how Elul then prepares us for Yom Kippur. And the whole time becomes very solemn and very serious. And it culminates with Yom Kippur. And we have the tikkun. Things are fixed and we don't eat and we don't drink and so on. But are things really fixed? All that we've done by that is fix the mistakes that we've made. But we haven't been proactive in creating something positive of taking the food and the drink and turning them into the service of God, which means Yom Kippur becomes a time where we get forgiven for the mistakes that we've made. And you know what? It's easy to be a Jew on Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is easy because what do you have to do? You have to be real serious. You don't eat, you don't drink. You know what's much more difficult? To be a good Jew on Purim. Because what do on Purim? We eat and we drink and we celebrate and we're happy. And that's much more difficult to do. That's much more of a challenge. But that's much more what Judaism is about. Which means if Yom Kippur is a time that we fix the mistake, Purim is a time where we say to God, now we're going to do it the right way. Now we're going to eat and drink and celebrate in the right way. And now we're going to celebrate the Torah which you've given us, but it's hidden. You don't see it. It's hidden, but in 3 months it will be completely revealed. And that's why the month of Adar flows into the month of Nisan, which flows in and connects to the month of Shavuos, and that's when the Torah is given by Shavuos. What we need to do on Purim is to start to be happy, because happiness doesn't happen in a second. You can't just be liberated in a second. And ultimately what we need to be liberated from or all these terrible things that haunt us. It's not just being a slave. It's being a slave to sadness. It's being a slave to fear. It's being a slave to all of these things that take our minds and take us away from realizing that God is in our lives and God cares about us, God takes care of us, and God can do absolutely anything for us. But when you don't see that, and you don't feel that, and you don't experience that, then you have sadness on your life. Purim is a story where you don't see the miracles, and that's exactly the point. Because the greatest miracles are seen, are the ones that happen every single day. It's the miracle when you get up in the morning, when your body works, you can stand on your feet, you can drink, I was going to say a cup of water, but I'll be extravagant, a cup of coffee, and you can feel life in you. And what that should bring us is an unbelievable amount of joy. But what do we end up doing? We end up taking everything for granted, and we end up expecting and feeling that we have so much more coming to us. And when we do that, we end up making ourselves sad. Because when you look at that cup and what you see is that the cup is half empty, then what you end up doing is saying, where's the rest of my cup? And instead, what should we be saying? Not that the cup is half full, but rather that God gave us every single thing that we need, and he gave us a real big cup to make it easy to carry. Have a happy month. Have a good Shabbos. Thank you.